So maybe we could begin with a traditional Buddhist bow, since this is a Buddhist practice, quite a traditional one. So this is basically honoring each other's unconditional goodness and worth. So actually what I'd like to do at the beginning, since there are newcomers and there will be every time, I kind of like to gather up the sort of the big picture and offer that first and then go into the particular topic for the evening. So way back when, how many months ago did we start this? About four, five, something like that?
Six.
Something along those lines. We began with the fact that samsara and nirvana are inseparable. Which is a kind of a big statement, because what is samsara? Mm-hmm. Is it a place? Sorry?
Events that just never end, like we keep, there's no beginning, there's no ending. Mm-hmm.
So would you say that's a psychological phenomenon or a physical phenomenon?
I think both at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think there's a whole lot we can do about the physical aspect of it. But in terms of the way we relate to reality, samsara has very much to do with that aspect of our response to what happens and the way we initiate all sorts of mischief that we propagate on ourselves. So samsara and nirvana being inseparable, well then, how you said suffering. What is so then? What is nirvana? If it's inseparable from samsara, how does that compute? Yeah, you can't have the one without the other, can you? I was reading. Where was I reading it? Trungpa Rinpoche was saying, and that's Trungpa Rinpoche up there, the man on the left. Was saying that without basic goodness, we couldn't experience samsara or suffering. It's like there's a contrast there that is part of, it's sort of built in, it's like two sides of a coin. So they flip back and forth, you know. One minute we're being really crazy, and then suddenly we see ourselves and we're wise. It can be that instantaneous. So that's that sense of them as inseparable. And it says in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which is a very ancient text dating back to the 10th century, 11th century, written by Gampopa, who's one of the founders of the Kargyu lineage, and therefore one of our forefathers, that this is a kind of a manual of getting enlightened. It's sort of like, if you actually understand what he's saying and you practice it, you have the sense of the view, the big picture, and then you have the sense of the practices that you do, and you have a sense of the fruition. And it actually is like guaranteed. What was that wonderful movie, Enlightenment Guaranteed? So there's that sense that we actually can work with our wild minds. We can actually become friends with ourselves, and we can actually lessen suffering. So that which is called samsara is empty by nature, a confused projection. So that's one of the things that's really important, is samsara and nirvana are both states of mind that are empty by nature. They're not solid, and you can't grasp them and hold on to them. So then the next thing we talked about in this class was who gets enlightened?
There's a list?
Yeah, there's a list. It's called us. It's actually what the good news is, that we have Buddha nature, that's the foundation for this path. In the Shambhala tradition, we call that basic goodness, and in the Nyingma tradition, we call it primordial purity. So, in all these different traditions, which all are in essence presented in our teachings in this center, there's this notion that we may not be able to figure it out all alone by ourselves, but our fundamental nature is calling to us all the time. And so that's why we want to get enlightened. That's why we want to stop suffering, because we know that there's something fishy about it. Confusion arises because we forget. and confusion is the basis of all the suffering that we experience. And we're going to talk a lot about suffering tonight, but just temporarily, let's define suffering. Would anybody like to pitch in here and say how they would define it?
I define it as attachment.
Attachment, that's a good one. Very good one.
Unsatisfactoriness.
Unsatisfactoriness. Another good one.
For me, I think it's any appropriation of any kind of perception that isn't clear, because you can hold on to anything and it can be suffering. Mm-hmm. Pleasure can be suffering.
Sorry?
Pleasure can be suffering.
Yes, pleasure can be.
It depends on the frame of mind and how you interpret mm-hmm. what you've seen mm-hmm. and how you group yeah. things together.
Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of interpretation
exactly.
and clinging, I believe you added. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about breaking your leg?
That becomes the physical suffering.
Yeah, yeah. So there's... Yeah.
But then there's some stories, if you break your leg, then the man didn't have to go to war, and you know, they sort of go on and on, and every kind of suffering is really a benefit, yeah.
Right. Well, I think that's an important point, is it's how we relate to those physical characteristics of reality, which could include physical pain, and it can include all sorts of other things that we will discuss further. But the thing is that, interestingly enough, this is the basic teachings that we have explored so far, but they all dovetail into tonight's discussion extremely elegantly. In fact, so does the medicine Buddha practice that we did, which is actually about the way we wander around mentally and emotionally in what we call samsara, which is basically, from the point of view of our experience, it's wild mind. It's unsettled mind. It's a mind that clings and grasps and rejects and morphs constantly and can't settle down. So it creates the realms, which we will talk about. So it says that all experiences are suffering from that point of view. But this is a kind of a challenging statement, because we're talking about from the point of view of samsara. All experiences are tinged with this kind of anxious, melancholy, unsettled sense. And it's not because we're bad. I think that's a really important thing to remember, that we have a sort of an extra layer of concept to work through as Westerners, because we have a tradition that says if you're hurt, you're being punished. So here we're saying, no, this is actually built into our experience. This is actually the way we experience reality, unless we can relax, unless we can actually befriend our experience and cease to fight it. And that's not the same thing as being passive. It's actually a very interactive and proactive thing to do, and it's called meditation. One of the other things that was said early on is, if we think we can do it by ourselves, lots of luck. You need help. So that's what's special about the Buddha. He also, of course, had help when he was supposedly in his many lifetimes learning how to be a Buddha. But when he actually went from being Siddhartha to being the Buddha, he worked so hard on his mind, and he really explored thoroughly and examined all of his experience. And he said, I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to give up. And his determination to do that led him then to experience enlightenment, to actually experience the end of suffering. And then he had to decide what to do. Well, am I going to help everybody out, or am I going to just disappear under the forest and be cool? And he said, no, I have to actually share this. So then we have teachings. We have teachings that are passed down from him, and we have what we call the spiritual teacher, which can be physical people who are masters, like Trungpa Rinpoche, who's the man who gave us this practice, or Trungpa Rinpoche, or Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, or many, many other very wise and enlightened people who they learned, they share, and then they pass on to their students, who actually become their representatives. So it's not like you have to go find somebody who's going to be your personal, private little, possession, but that we actually are assisting each other And so we have the sense of the teacher, who could be a spiritual friend, who could be you and me, and who can also be a book. And I brought a book tonight. This I wanted to share with everybody. This is the book I was telling you about, Jim. This is a wonderful, wonderful, very traditional text by Trungpa Rinpoche, and it tells all about the Four Noble Truths, and the first noble truth that the Buddha taught was the truth of suffering. And it's very clear-eyed and very unflinching. And that's something that, you know, we still have a sort of Victorian sentimentality that says, oh, you know, suffering is sweet and sad, and, you know, but we want to kind of tidy it up. But this is much more like, let's just look at our actual experience. That's tonight's topic. And in fact, what we've been going through this last time and this time are the instructions of the spiritual master called the method. These are ways we can actually experience truth. We can explore and we can find out for ourselves, which was something that the Buddha really emphasized was he's not going to do it for us. He gives us the help that we need, and then we go off and we do our own hard work. And that isn't because we're so individual, you know, rugged individuals, but because our fundamental nature is calling us to do that. And nobody else can do it because it's this particular unique expression of that, which then turns out to be totally like interdependent on all the world around us. So, let's see, where am I? So last class was actually on impermanence. That was the basis of beginning the instructions of the guru, or the spiritual master, or the spiritual friend, or a book that you pick up, or a class that we take together. So that is, I don't know how you handled it, but it sounded very interesting. People experience something about impermanence, which, by the way, when the Buddha taught, he gave all these different kinds of teachings, and the first noble truth that he gave was on suffering, but then he got very particular and very precise and incisive about what that means. And so, for instance, there are three marks of existence. And existence is marked by impermanence, by suffering, and by no abiding self, no abiding independent self. So the first instruction is actually to look at impermanence, to see how things rise, fall, change constantly. You know, in modern physics, we don't have any trouble with understanding that from the point of view of how little atomic particles are buzzing around and changing, and our blood is pumping, and we're getting old, and the sun is rising and setting, and the seasons, and blah, blah, blah. It's pretty obvious, yet we still don't believe it. So this is a conversation that we have with ourselves where we actually pay attention to what reality is doing and what our minds are doing, which are very, very fickle. Anybody's mind here not fickle? So you could say that the next mark of existence is what we're talking about tonight, and that's the truth of dukkha, suffering. And there are various translations of that. And we've talked a little bit about some of the ways we define samsara. So how would we define dukkha? This is familiar to many of you, this term.
Well, you have a good list already, you know, satisfaction, anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So distinguish that from just simple pain, you know, like you stub your toe or you break your leg.
Agitation. Which for me has a more continuing.
Sorry?
It's more a verb.
Pain is what happens when you stub your toe. Suffering is what happens when you get all carried away by it.
Great. Excellent. Yeah, I think that nailed it.
So the dukkha would be more of a psychological aspect of the suffering?
Yeah, I would say so. Wouldn't you, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when fundamentally, dukkha arises because we simply don't trust, on some level, our own natures. And this is said to have arisen from beginningless time. We're not personally at fault for it happening. We're not the bad guys, and everybody else has got it together. And so we come to the Shambhala Center and comfort each other. Everybody feels this way. Remember high school or junior high school and the misery of hormones raging and terrified of the other gender, the other sex, and all, you know, all that stuff, not knowing where your place was in the world. And you remember, I mean, that's how it was for me anyway. I assume it is for most people, that unless they have a really confident family. I could remember these young people who just went around and acted like they were so cool, and then you looked at them and you saw suffering, you know? And it really doesn't change that much. We just get more sophisticated at pretending. So one of the things we're doing is we're taking away the layers of pretense when we meditate. That's what we're doing. And we're looking clear in a clear-eyed way at what is, which is that we actually have these constant maneuvers to not be here fully. Because I don't know why. I mean, we have ignorance because we forget our nature. We have fear of ourselves and of the world. We then have these strategies of passion and aggression and ignoring. These are all part of the Buddha's teachings, and we could go on a long time about them, but I won't. But, you know, we recognize those things in ourselves. And so what happens is we wander. It's called migrating through the six realms, which was a good deal of what this chapter was about, was all these states of mind or states of being that occur because we can't settle into our basic nature. And it seems so sad when you think about it. Our basic nature is it's fundamental goodness, it's purity. And here we are not getting it. And then we want to try harder and be far, you know, more fierce with ourselves or something. And that sort of like makes it worse, you know, it makes it worse. So our whole training in meditation is to do the counterintuitive thing and relax. Relax and trust. So one of the ways we do that actually is by dissecting suffering, by dissecting dukkha, by understanding its nature very, very thoroughly, being willing to explore what it's all about and how we're doing it personally, not just in an abstract way, but in a very personal, everyday life, every moment-to-moment way. And, the Buddha gave tremendous numbers of teachings on witnessing our being, and not just witnessing it from afar, but having this sort of a tender, accommodating approach to every moment, recognizing when we're feeling crappy, recognizing when we're feeling good, recognizing when we're fending off, you know, bit by bit, moment by moment. One of the things that's really important in contextualizing suffering is that it's not like everything's grim and horrible all the time. You know, there's so much tenderness, there's so much love, there's so much brilliance and beauty in the world as well. And so it's not like we're denying that, but we're watching what we do to it, what we do to ourselves around it. And so what do we do? Three ways we can do things. One is what I would call, they call it the suffering of suffering, which you might say is basic suffering, which has to do with you're born, and I don't know, I witnessed my two children being born, and they were quite interested, actually. It wasn't like, oh, this is terrible, you know, because there's this whole section in the Jewel Ornament that talks about how suffering starts in the womb and the baby hates it and all this stuff, and I'm going, they clearly never had a baby. Babies are quite interested in the whole thing. They haven't quite gotten the picture that they're supposed to reinterpret it as suffering. But in a way, it's very awkward, you know. Being born is awkward. You can say that about it. And that's a form of dukkha, you know. It's not easy. And then you grow up, and there's growing pains, and then there's aging, and there's aging pains, and there's old age, and there's really aging pains, and there's sickness in between it all, and then you die. And that's just the fact of life. We cannot escape that. The Buddha himself died when he was 80 years old. He did not, you know, live forever. He said, everything that's composite falls apart. Well, if there's anything that's composite, it's our bodies. It's our earth. You know, it's constantly changing. So if things are going to fall apart, that's just the nature of it. And so when we regard that as seriously problematic to my personal survival of my personal ego, it's really painful. And we can't trick ourselves by saying, oh, it's all cool. You know, it's all good. I'll just pretend that it doesn't hurt. Because that is totally not genuine. It totally divorces us from our experience. The other way that we experience suffering is the impermanence of our experience. Tonight we had a really yummy dessert. We had a great dinner, in fact, and a yummy dessert. And now it's over. And we could have said, oh, I wish I had more. Or I wish I could keep eating as I'm coming here and, you know, continuing to have this pleasurable experience. Things change. And sometimes we get what we don't want. You know, you order something and it tastes terrible, or you think you're going to have a great time with your friends and instead you end up in an argument, or, you know, you think that this is going to make me really happy, this thing. I'm so happy right now. It feels so good. I have such relief because something good happened, and it goes away. And then on top of that, not only do we have these moments of things that work out, but then not only do we lose it, but we worry about losing it before we even have. Familiar? Mm-hmm. And half the time, we don't even know what would give us this sense of good of well-being. You know, we're wandering around saying, well, gee, maybe if I bought this, or if I only could achieve this particular skill, then I would be happier, at least happier. So, you know, that we have all these little tricks we try to play on ourselves, and they fail. They fail constantly, and they make us very unhappy. And one of the ways that they make us unhappy is that we feel really anxious because we cannot get anything to sit still. We can't get it to sit still and behave. It's like Alice and the flamingos and the hedgehogs all the time. And then the third kind of suffering is the suffering of conditioned existence. And this is where we actually can examine our experience very intimately. And we can see that we have this stubborn misconception that we exist as a solid, separate entity that needs to be propped up all the time, defended, fed, nurtured, protected. In the Shambhala tradition, we talk about the cocoon, which is sort of like trying to wrap padding around ourselves, and which totally cuts us off, actually, from genuine experience, which is quite sharp and penetrating, and not necessarily pleasant, but certainly it's real. That's what actually gives us a sense of being alive, not that padding, not that giant carapace, this armor that we try to put around ourselves. So, the thing that happens with that is that when we operate from this false sense of self, which is the shorthand is ego, we wander through the six realms. And how many people actually read this chapter? Didn't they love the hell realm? I mean, my God, 3/4 of the talk and the writing that he gave was this very traditional medieval description of the hell realms. And I'm like, these are your version, you know? I can think of some really good ones myself if I really wanted to do that. And they just go on and on and on, and they build and they change, and you think you're going to get out of this, well, now we're going to poke holes in you, and then we're going to set you on fire, and then we're going to freeze you, and you're going to... But what I thought was really interesting about them was that they had this sense of how long you're stuck in them. Did you notice that?
Yeah, yeah.
And have we been in that place?
Millions of years. Right?
Yeah, and when we do feel like we're in a hell realm, isn't that exactly how it feels? This will never change. I am stuck here forever. And then, of course, you know, we continue through the realms. There's the hungry ghost where you can never get enough. You know, whatever we have, it's not enough. And then the sort of the animal realm, which is the realm of just lumping along and not really paying attention. We have the human realm, which is a balance of suffering with enough delight in existence that you want to get enlightened. And then you have the competitive, jealous gods, thank you. Jealous gods realm, who are always trying to get into the god realm and getting shoved back by the gods and saying, I'm taking your girlfriend from you. Or, I have more than you have. I have a bigger boat. I have a bigger house. Whatever. And then the god realm, where everybody seems to be so happy, and they've got their garlands, or they have their I don't know, what do they have? They have lots.
Bliss.
You know, they can meet famous people and hang out with them. And then, of course, it plummets. We've all had that, right? We've had that experience. We're feeling groovy. We're feeling good. We have it all. Oh, no. Doubt creeps in. We start to feel crappy. We start to feel like, I can't hold on to it. Oh, no, no, here it comes. And then we plunge back into this anxiety and despair. And, you know, it just keeps going and going and going. And that's the six realms. And the interesting thing about this long discussion, he sticks something in there in the middle. He says, we can be very literal about this, or we can recognize that all of this arises from our minds. Did you guys tweak that little bit there? He said, that is the Kagyu tradition. So, or Kagyu, excuse me, the Kagyu tradition. What's that? Kagyu, Kagyupa. So actually, this is the Vajrayana tradition in general, is that we don't get fooled into externalizing that which we can actually deal with personally. So does that make sense to people? I mean, it gives us a lot more to work on, actually. So what I thought I would do is ask you to kind of cluster together in threes, and maybe talk about your experience of the realms and what, A, what it feels like, and B, what happens when you pay attention to it. So could we do that for just a few minutes? Is that willing to try that out?
So, could you count us off in three? 1 to 3 minutes.
Okay, 1, 2, 3. Jim, do you want to set out or do you want to be part of it?
Okay. I was in a very happy realm, so I may not be able to.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm always in a very joyful realm, so I'm here.
Okay, so he can represent the God realm here. Okay, so 1, 2, and then Deb, you'll be 3. Cynthia, Walter, and Zadar?
Ocean.
I'm so sorry. Ocean, of course.
Why are we doing this?
Why are we doing this? Because I think it's more personal.
No, but we're going to wind up with large groups.
Of three? Oh, should we do 4?
No, we're doing groups of 3. So 1, 2, and 3 will get together.
Oh, I see. All right.
What were you thinking?
All one. Okay.
I didn't understand.
Yeah. Would people like to share anything that was particularly significant to them about their conversation with each other? Sorry? No?
That was pretty intense.
To be in the room with everybody?
Everybody
was
finding lots to talk about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The last thing we talked about in this group of 3 was very interesting. When you get hooked in some sort of state or mind state, you actually have to find the body anchors that allow you to support that state. Because if we actually structure our whole form as well to support that.
Mm.
And if you notice when your body's dysfunctional for whatever reason, you go to somebody to fix it, then they can spot you and say, okay, there's some sort of emotional stuff here. It's nothing to do with joints or whatever, but you're totally ramped up and you're doing this to yourself, basically.
Yeah, yeah. There are people who actually can't identify their emotional state and they think that they have physical problems, and it takes a long time to actually recognize. You know, of course, there's the body-mind connection, which is totally inseparable, but there's like taking care of the body sometimes doesn't take care of the mind, because the mind needs to participate. What else came up?
Well, we just, I think we're, you guys, you correct me if I'm wrong. I think that we found that one thing we had in common was that there were things that we wanted and were attached to the idea of wanting them. And then through a process of, I'm thinking Buddhism, teachings, is that we become aware of the what that attachment, what the suffering is with that. Mm-hmm. And then the work of stopping that, or calming that down, or just it's like allowing that will arise, whatever it is that we want. You know, mm-hmm. A few things were mentioned, like a jaguar, a trip to Maui, being a famous person, those kind of things. I think it's pretty common for all of us. And how that might come up now, but we just allow it to move on.
Mm, yeah, very good point. Yeah. Next thing we want.
Well, hopefully that it just won't, it'll stop arising. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not near that yet.
Yeah, I was jesting a little bit there. Anything else anybody want to share?
I think that was similar to what we were talking about, wasn't it? That's from some grants and bells from the way that
striving for trying to get to some accomplishment and mm-hmm. never really arriving at that, but kept on wanting to accomplish
something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ambition, but at the same time trying to calm down. Like, that really makes sense to me. You know, trying to mm-hmm. be ambitious for mm-hmm. something, mm-hmm. having these hopes to, to mm-hmm. time's running out and I want to do these things. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time trying to, have that awareness, especially through meditation and reading that I've been mm-hmm. doing lately, of just trying to calm down and just mm-hmm. keep attentive on the path. And if it happens naturally, then it will happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like having a bucket list. And one of my bucket list items was going to New Orleans. Well, I did this last in March, and it's like, meh. Well, it wasn't bad. It was just I built this thing up. Mm. And really, mm-hmm. I didn't need to spend that $1,500.
Marketing strategy, bucket list.
Well, that makes me think about what about bucket lists,
Yeah. How meaningful are they?
Movies, but really.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things that strikes me about all of these realms that we're discussing, is that the sort of the relentless, always more, always something new, is how sad it is. How sad it is. That, in a way it seems to me that they seem really permanent, but they all seem very fickle at the same time. Or we're fickle with them. And even the Buddha talked about the fact that there are states of meditative concentration that can last for a long time. And he tried them all and said, oh, look, I came down. There's a sense that you were trying really hard to get something, and it's the same exact thing we were just talking about, but in terms of meditation. So one of the things that I find very helpful, well, there are two things. One is something that Jim and I were talking about earlier that he suggested that I mention, which is this sad quality is about not just me. We look around and we're looking at each other and resonating with one another, and then we go out and we see other people. We have an interaction maybe with somebody we're paying for our gasoline to, and they're standing behind the counter and it's 11 o'clock at night and they're tired. And there are all these moments of connection with others that are embedded in this, recognizing that quality, that it's universal, that we share it, and that that's very tenderizing. And the other aspect of that is that the particular way we practice these moments are not moments of to be regarded as moments of despair, of oh God, I did it again, you know, tearing my hair out. They're moments actually of, now I'm awake, I saw it. And not just I saw it, but there's a feeling of awake that occurs quite naturally that we can't own. But it's so clear and sweet. And then, you know, it fades, but it has its impact every time. It has its impact because it's coming from our fundamental nature. And we, the more that it happens, the more we're able to return to that nature with some sense of where what it is. You know, we're still kind of incoherent about it. There's still a lot of veils and so forth. But I'm reminded of when we were traveling many years ago in Italy, northern Italy. We stopped at this little, I don't know how we stopped. We were hitchhiking or something. Stopped in front of this little store that sold vegetables that were straight from their backyard, practically. And we bought a pear. And it was sublime. It was the best pear I had ever tasted in my life. I didn't know before that what a pear was supposed to taste like. And every time I taste a pear now, that's what I taste. I don't just taste this sort of disappointing mass-produced pear. I taste the essence of pear in there. I can recognize it. So that's what, every time we have a moment of really being with whatever is, including our moments of not being there or being lost and coming back, there's a connection that deepens. And it's not like it's particularly like linear process at all. But there's definitely something that is reliable in our experience. That it doesn't mean that we, as ordinary folk, suffer any less, have our any less dukkha overall. But there's a sense of perspective as well, that it's based on kindness to ourselves and to our world. And I think that that's pretty much leads into your next presentation next month. You didn't know that? You don't have to say anything about it now. But I was thinking that it would be really important that we all get to your class, because we know when it is.
Yes, it's in 2016. No, it's next month, September. Labor Day. The first Monday is Labor Day, and so it's the second.
September 14th.
What is it?
September 14th.
Okay.
September 14th. All right, that's great. Yeah. And so, pardon?
Well, I'll just be back.
Yeah, we'll be there in spirit. We won't be here this time because we'll be in France. Sorry.
Can I add something a little bit based on what you presented?
Oh, please.
Earlier, right?
Yeah.
Because as you were talking, I thought, well, a thought occurred to me. And you mentioned something about samsara being inseparable from the mind. Now, I began to think that word is very important.
It is.
You know, we look at samsara, we think we have some idea what the mind might be. But I think the real crucial operative word is inseparable. And what I was thinking is that maybe too, you know, we're so much more tuned into the experience of pain. Like somebody said, you could be happy for a very long time if you're willing to eat, you know, bread out of iron balls. And I'd say, I'll have to pass. I can't do it because the pain is so intimate. And what I think about maybe with this experience of presenting these realms is so horrific is that the more we understand about that, and because we understand the inseparability, the more clearly we can understand what the release from this is, you know? It's when we try to get away, when we try to get away from the realms, that we actually keep ourselves trapped in them,
you know? Exactly.
And if we understand them clearly, I like that word inseparable. I just got so inspired by that. I thought I had to add those 2 cents for the total mind, that it's really crucial to understand, you know, what they are actually like, so that we then can't find ourselves, you know, having transcended them to an extent by their very nature.
I, for the last while, I've been thinking a lot about Buddhist teachings, theory, they're about human beings, right? About human beings. And that means that we all have experience, whether we've recognized it or not. We've had these experiences. You know, so the inseparability reveals, in a way, it reveals where we have ignored.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's our ideas,
yes,
that make the hell realm hell realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or our experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway,
yeah,
thank you for that. A very important, crucial point.
Very important. Yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking, just thinking about all the fires California's burning up. It's like, is this what they meant by hell? You know, like fire and it's happening here too in BC. But I mean, that ties right into karma and its results.
Yes.
Chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, karma is very much, thank you for mentioning that, because I meant to and I forgot, that what we're studying when we're meditating is the way we are creating our own karma. We're actually in the process of unwinding our tendencies to create more karma. And Trungpa Rinpoche once said that when we meditate, we're not creating karma, which I thought was a very interesting thing to say. And that the other thing that he said that I think is really helpful in this,
or creating positive karma, possibly, when we meditate.
Right? Well, maybe, yeah. But I think it's more like it's a neutral space,
yeah,
where we can understand karma and unwind our attachment to it. Because not attachment in the sense of, I'm going to find a gated community of happiness where I never feel anything again. You know, it's not like that. It's like, actually, he talked about the true, being a true human being, a full human being, is like having you're flying a kite, but it's hooked into your heart, and it's always pulling you forward.
Mm-hmm. That's great. What did you say that?
I don't remember, but Frank Berliner mentioned it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So you can call and ask him.
Okay.
Google.
Yeah, but he once said, you know, that he was a funny man. He was very humorous. He was very precise and could really just, you know, look at you and you'd go, oh my God, I'm like Swiss cheese, you know. And I thought I was a real person, and now I'm not sure. And then he once said to a friend of mine that who was crying at the time, and how do I stop crying and how do I deal with my tears? He said, and he'd been very funny that evening, and he said, I'm crying all the time inside. So there's something about being willing to have both joy and sadness intermingled, that I think is very central to the inseparability quality.
So there's some way to learn to hold these things more.
Yes, yes, and I think that's part of what we work on, not only in our meditation but in our daily life, that the events of our life, the way we respond to them, wake us up to that possibility, to that actuality. And we don't flinch from it anymore, which is one of the things you were saying, Jim, about not flinching from...
The comfort of the Sangha, which in our sharing, however that happens, whether it's conscious or unconscious, reminds us that we are all having the same experience. We have different names for us, but we do, and that is so powerful. It's something that our culture now, our Western culture, and it's starting to happen in the East too, is that as we get further and further apart, as we lose touch with each other, we get angrier, we get sadder, we get all of those things that aren't about nurturing. But when we come together, you know, we begin to find that caring.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Important.
Yeah, it's not abstract at all, is it?
No, it's not abstract.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we dedicate the merit because whatever insight we've gained is public property. And so we're just reminding ourselves of that fact.
May all obtain omniscience, may I defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the ripens wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound and brilliant glory.